the 1920s until 1954, Nanny Doss was viewed as a loving woman, a grandmother who was just as sweet as pie. But things are rarely as they seem. In 1954, this giggling granny, as she became known, revealed that her weapon of choice in a string of murders was a secret ingredient she often put in pies she baked for her family. This is the mystery of the giggling granny. This is Southern Mysteries.
It's gonna be all right. These ain't dark or troubled times. It's a day like any other day. You got a dark and troubled mind, all right. You hold that baby tight, and I swear if you can hear me, then everything gonna be just fine, all right. All right.
Welcome to Southern Mysteries, exploring historical mysteries and legendary figures of the American South. I'm your host, Shannon Ballard. This week marks the celebration of Thanksgiving here in the American South and across the United States. Families will sit down to enjoy turkey with all the fixins, and afterwards, there will be pie. Lots of pie. Pies lovingly baked by grandmas who make some of the best pumpkin, pecan, and apple pie you will ever taste. It's a quaint day, until you come to terms with the truth of Thanksgiving Day in America. Not the story we were taught in elementary school textbooks. What's really celebrated in America this week is not an idyllic partnership of 17th century European pilgrims and New England Indians sharing a meal in peace and friendship. The truth is, we're celebrating something darker as we travel to the homes of family and friends to share that turkey and pie. The first Thanksgiving Day was in 1637. It was the day the Massachusetts colony governor, John Winthrop, proclaimed a Thanksgiving to celebrate the safe return of a band of colonial volunteer hunters. You see, they had returned from their mission to massacre 700 Pequot Indians, men, women, and children, all murdered. Granny's apple pie doesn't seem as tasty when you know the truth behind the tradition. Things are rarely as they seem. And that was true of a granny who was known for her apple pie and prune cakes. Her name was Nanny Doss. But in time, she would become known as the Giggling Granny. The moniker was bestowed on her by police, who interrogated her and heard her confess to the murder of 10 family members. Nanny loved baking, and to people who were on the outside looking in, she was a beloved grandmotherly figure who had the cutest giggle and was known for the pies she loved to cook for her family. Pies that she would sprinkle with sugar, fresh from the oven, so the sweetness would help disguise her special ingredient. And that special ingredient may cause you to pause before you take a bite of the next pie a loved one bakes for you, because things may not be as sweet as they seem. Nanny Hazel, or Nanny as she always preferred to be called, was born in Blue Mountain, Alabama in November of 1905. Blue Mountain's a small farming community in northeast Alabama. Nanny was one of five siblings, all of whom had complicated relationships with her parents, James and Louisa Hazel. James Hazel was hot-tempered and controlling, and Nanny's mother was deathly afraid of him. She did all she could do to care for her family, but it was a different time. James was the head of the house, and Louisa did as she was told. Nanny and her siblings had a difficult childhood. They were kept away from school by their father, who made them work as farmhands from a very young age. From the age of five, Nanny would have to work in the fields and clear the lands of weeds and debris. When she was around 7 years old, the family took a train to visit relatives in South Alabama. Riding a train was a treat for young Nanny, who had never been away from the farm before. But during what had been a magical experience for this young girl, the train was forced to make an emergency stop. And the force, as the train began to break, pushed Nanny into a metal bar on the seat in front of her. For months after the accident, she suffered pain and blackouts and suffered severe headaches for the rest of her life. In an interview later in life, Nanny would say that she always felt that train accident changed something in her head forever. As the years passed, Nanny Hazel began to mature, and she started doing what so many little girls do, dream of love, someone to love her unconditionally. And in Nanny's case, she wanted someone to help her escape her controlling father, who by now had forbidden her and her sisters from doing anything that could attract boys, including wearing makeup or wearing any kind of attractive clothing. Nanny's father told his daughters that they were to never attend dances or any social event in town. Her father said this was to prevent her from being assaulted by boys, but their father was the problem. The girls were being assaulted by their own dad. It's no surprise that Nanny became obsessed with reading romance novels. To dream of another world and escape the weight of pain and feeling of being caged in her home. Nanny's favorite part of romance novels and magazines were the Lonely Hearts columns. Before Tinder and all manner of options in the world of online dating, one of the best prospects for a woman or a man looking for love would be to place an ad in their local newspaper detailing who they were and the kind of relationship they were looking for. Nanny read those ads over and over again and dreamed of love. In 1921, at the age of 16, Nanny invited a friend to dinner, a new friend named Charlie Braggs. They had met at a linen factory where they worked. Nanny thought he was a nice young man, but she was shocked when her father told her she should marry Charlie. Nanny's father liked that Charlie had a good job, was devoted to his own mother, and had no plans to leave Blue Mountain, Alabama. Even in marriage, Nanny's father controlled her life. 4 months after meeting Charlie Braggs, 16-year-old Nanny Hazel married him. Nanny and Charlie had 4 daughters within the first 4 years of marriage. The pressures of marriage and motherhood took their toll on Nanny, as Charlie's mother reminded her constantly that she wasn't good enough for her son. Nanny turned to liquor to deal with the stress, and eventually Nanny and Charlie were seeking comfort in the arms of others. And soon after the birth of their 4th child, their 2 middle daughters died just months apart. Both died mysteriously from what medical professionals called food poisoning. Their deaths were ruled accidental. Charlie was heartbroken and suspicious. It felt like too much of a coincidence to him. So much so that he refused to eat meals prepared by Nanny. Eventually, the stress and paranoia got to Charlie, who fled with their oldest daughter, Melvina. He left behind the newborn, Florine, a decision that was questioned. But some say he left Florine because he didn't believe this was his child to take. Charlie returned to Blue Mountain 1 year later, in the summer of 1928. And he didn't come home alone. Along with his daughter, Melvina, Charlie came home with another woman who had a child of her own. Nanny got the message loud and clear. She packed her belongings, dressed Florine and Melvina, left, and filed for divorce. Charlie Braggs would become known as the one husband who got away from Nanny alive. 2 years after Nanny divorced Charlie Braggs, she was alone and yearning for love again when she came across a Lonely Hearts ad for Frank Harrelson, a 23-year-old factory worker from Jacksonville, Alabama. He wooed her with romantic poetry, and she wooed him with her apple pie and all manner of baked goods. They met in person and married in 1929. A few months into the marriage, Nanny discovered that she had married not only an alcoholic, but a man who had a criminal record for assault. But they remained together, would remain married for 16 years. In 1943, Melvina, Nanny's oldest daughter, gave birth to her first child, Robert. This was Nanny's first grandchild. 2 years later, Melvina gave birth to another child, a daughter, who died soon after birth. Melvina would later tell her husband and her sister, Florine, that she suspected her mother had done something to hurt the baby, but acknowledged she was on heavy pain medication after labor and may have been hallucinating. She brushed it off as paranoia. After Melvina and her husband lost their 2nd child, they drifted apart and separated. Melvina started dating a soldier who Nanny didn't like, and she let Melvina know. But Melvina continued dating the man. Without telling Melvina, Nanny took out an insurance policy of $500 for her grandson, Robert. Soon after, Melvina and Nanny argued again about Melvina's choice in men. Melvina left Robert in the care of Nanny while she went to her father's house to try to calm down. On July 7, 1945, Robert died from asphyxiation, and within 2 months after his death, Nanny cashed in on Robert's life insurance. With the end of World War II came celebrations across the United States. The country was in the mood to celebrate, and Nanny's husband, Frank, was ready to celebrate too. One night, he began drinking and kept drinking, and Frank Harrelson assaulted his wife. The next morning, Nanny tended her rose garden and found one of Frank's whiskey bottles buried in her garden. Once again, she found herself in a marriage where there was no romance, nothing like she had read about in her romance novels. So Nanny decided to take action. She took Frank's whiskey bottle, topped it off with rat poison, and waited for Frank Harrelson to consume his liquor. He finished off that bottle, and soon after, Frank Harrelson became very ill. And on September 15th, 1945, he died a very painful death. Nanny found comfort in the insurance money payout from Frank's death. She used the money to buy 10 acres of land and build a small house for herself just outside of Jacksonville, Alabama. Nanny was not comfortable being on her own. She continued to dream of that romance she read of in her favorite books and magazines. A man to sweep her off her feet and treat her like a queen. So Nanny went back to reading the Lonely Hearts ads in her local paper. In 1947, 37-year-old Nanny met 47-year-old Arlie Lanning. And within 2 days of meeting, they were married. They settled into their new life in Arlie's home in Lexington, North Carolina. But by the end of their first month of marriage, Nanny realized she had once again married an alcoholic womanizer. Nanny took solace in Arlie not being a violent man, but she wasn't happy. She wanted more and felt that if Arlie could sleep around, she could too. So Nanny would take off for weeks and sometimes months at a time. Her neighbors always believed this sweet, church-going woman was spending time away with family. But Nanny was really spending that time with other men she hoped could love her. Occasionally, Arnie would receive a telegram that read, "Send money" or "Be home soon." And Nanny would return home, time and time again, playing the role of the perfect housewife, going to church on Sundays, tending her garden, and baking her famous apple pie and prune cakes. But by the early 1950s, Nanny would find herself comforted by her neighbors over and over again, comforting her because it seemed every family member she came into contact with would meet an untimely end. On February 16th, 1952, after close to 5 years of marriage, Arlie Lanning became ill and died. Nanny was comforted by her neighbors, who were shocked over the death, just as she seemed to be. Doctors presumed Arlie had died of a heart attack, that it may have been brought on by flu that had been going around at the time. He had, after all, had a fever and suffered severe stomach pains and sickness before he died. Doctors believed his body just gave out, so no autopsy was performed. Arlie Lanning didn't leave his home to his wife. He left it to his sister, but his sister would never take possession of that house, because within 2 months of Arlie's death, the house was destroyed by fire. The only thing that survived was Nanny's favorite thing in that house, the TV set. Conveniently, that TV had been in the back seat of Nanny's car when the house burned down. She told friends she was heading to have it repaired when she heard about the fire. The insurance company issued a check to Arlie Lanning, deceased, which happened to be mailed to his widow, Nanny, who had been staying with Arlie's mother. Nanny was, as she put it, just blessed to receive that insurance check so she could leave town and head back to Alabama to be with her dear dying sister, Dovey. Dovey had been ill. She had cancer. But the end didn't seem near for Dovey, which is why the family was surprised when Dovey died, soon after her sister, Nanny, came to visit. By 1952, Nanny was 47 years old and felt she needed to try a different method to land her next husband. After all, Nanny still believed in love, and she was on a constant journey to find that perfect life partner. This time, it was with the Diamond Club Circle, a service for mature men and women looking for love. Nanny connected with Richard Morton from Emporia, Kansas. After they had connected, Richard Morton wrote Diamond Circle asking them to delete his and Nanny's names from the availability list and thanking them for introducing him to the sweetest and most wonderful woman he had ever met. On January 12, 1953, Nanny married husband number four, and soon after, her mother Lou came to stay with them. But sadly, Nanny's mother died of what doctors called an unexplained poisoning soon after she moved in with Nanny and Richard. Despite the loss of her mother, Nanny told friends that she was happy to start fresh in a new town with her new man. He wasn't an alcoholic like her previous husbands, but Nanny would learn she was indeed married to another womanizer, and she felt she had no time to waste. She had to handle the situation, which in Nanny's mind meant that she had to bake her husband a pie with her secret ingredient, rat poisoning. On May 19, 1953, less than 6 months after he married Nanny, Richard Morton died of what doctors called unexplained poisoning. Once again, there were no suspicions of Nanny, no autopsy ordered. And soon after, two of Nanny's sisters would die. Both of the women would become ill with stomach cramps and convulsions. No one understood how this could happen, but it seemed Nanny did some baking while she was visiting them. People continued to reach out to Nanny to express their condolences over her great loss. So much loss for one woman to bear. But Nanny found the strength to move forward. And quickly, within a month of her fourth husband's death, Nanny married her fifth husband, Samuel Doss of Tulsa, Oklahoma. They married in July of 1953. Samuel was nothing like the men Nanny had married before. He was a man who was committed to church, and as Nanny saw it, nothing else. Samuel didn't approve of Nanny's romance novels, which caused tension in their marriage. Nanny saw Samuel as a boring man. She took out two life insurance policies on him, and soon after, Samuel was diagnosed with what was believed to be a digestive tract infection. He went to the hospital, was treated, and released to return home on October 5th of 1954. But he would not be home for long. Samuel Doss died on October 12, 1954. Nanny Doss always referred to her husband Samuel as that boring one. But he would prove to be more interesting than Nanny Doss believed him to be. You see, Samuel Doss would be Nanny's undoing. Samuel's sudden illness, his treatment, then release from the hospital so soon before he died, led to doctors ordering an autopsy to try to make sense of Samuel's death. The autopsy showed there was enough arsenic in Samuel Doss's body to kill 20 men. Arsenic that was in Nanny's preferred brand of rat poison. And that's when doctors and investigators put two and two together and promptly arrested 49-year-old Nanny Doss and charged her with murder. Nanny Doss was questioned by detectives who pushed her to admit that she had poisoned her husband, Samuel. Nanny pushed back, saying it had been Samuel's coffee or some meat he ate that must have made him sick. Detectives reminded Nanny that arsenic doesn't come naturally with those things. The more investigators pushed Nanny to confess, the more she would giggle, saying she would never poison a soul. But after hours of questioning Nanny, hours of giggling fits, this sweet grandmotherly type, as they referred to her, she finally gave them what they needed. Special Agent Ray Page was heading the investigation, and he told Nanny that he had made phone calls, and he now knew that Samuel was her fourth husband to die. All had the same symptoms. Nanny giggled again and told Page that he was a nice-looking man, but he was foolish. She didn't, just couldn't have killed her beloved husbands. Paige pushed her once again, and Nanny giggled more. Then the unexpected happened. Nanny Doss confessed that she had indeed poisoned Samuel's coffee and pies. But she said she didn't do it to be mean. She said she did it because Samuel had annoyed her. He wouldn't let her watch her favorite programs on the TV and didn't like her romance magazines. Nanny wondered aloud to the shocked investigators, "What's a woman to do?" Once Nanny confessed to murdering Samuel, the floodgates seemed to open. She confessed to killing Richard Morton, Arlie Lanning, and Frank Harrelson too. Confessed, again, between fits of giggling like a little girl. She said she was looking for romance, and they were duds. And she told investigators that if the ghosts of all three men were in the room, they were either drunk or sleeping. And Nanny wasn't done talking yet. In between those fits of giggles, Nanny confessed to the murder of her sisters, her grandchildren, her own mother, and her mother-in-law. Those investigators realized that they were looking not at a giggling granny, but at a monster. The day after Nanny confessed, authorities from Tulsa traveled to Kansas, North Carolina, and Alabama to oversee exhumations of Nanny's husbands, her mother, her sister Dovey, her nephew Robert, and her mother-in-law. Arsenic traces were heavy in every one of the deceased spouses and in Nanny's mother. Nanny's first husband, Charlie Braggs, asked that the bodies of his two daughters be exhumed and tested, along with the others Nanny had confessed to murdering. But prosecutors said they had more than enough to send Nanny away for a very long time. Several days after Nanny was arrested, a man from North Carolina realized he had been corresponding with a killer. John Keel, a dairy farmer in North Carolina, had been corresponding with Nanny and had his heart set on meeting and marrying her. He had been wooing her with letters, and Nanny had been wooing him with homemade cakes. John Keel contacted authorities, letting them know he had letters from Nanny and asking if they needed anything from him. And they told him what they needed was for him to go to the doctor for a checkup. It turns out Nanny hadn't used arsenic in the cakes she baked for John Keel, who was very relieved to survive his short-lived, long-distance romance with the giggling granny. In all, Nanny Doss confessed to 10 murders, although family knew she had killed more. The state of Oklahoma centered their case on the death of Samuel Doss. Alabama, North Carolina, and Kansas prosecutors wanted the chance to try Nanny, but she would only ever face trial in Oklahoma. Nanny did undergo a series of mental evaluations. She was found to be sane and of sound mind, and her trial was set to start on June 2, 1955, but in May of that year, Nanny followed the advice of her lawyers, who told her she should plead guilty. Nanny Doss was sentenced to life imprisonment, not the electric chair, which had been the normal sentence for those who committed murder in Oklahoma in 1955, but she was a woman, and a judge said he had no intention of sending a woman to the electric chair. Nanny's case did lead to change in the state of Oklahoma. The state legislature passed a law requiring an examination by a medical examiner of all individuals who died without being attended by a physician. Nanny Doss spent the rest of her life in prison, reading her romance novels and dreaming of love. She was a model prisoner and known in prison as a jokester and that woman with that famous giggle. She would often joke that when the prison would get shorthanded in the kitchen, she'd always offer to help out, and she didn't understand why they always said no. Nanny Doss died of leukemia in the prison's hospital on June 2, 1965. She left this world never showing remorse or regret for the lives she had taken. Occasionally, in newspaper articles and features about Nanny, reporters would print that Nanny blamed her murderous tendencies on that head injury she suffered as a child, saying it explained how a woman could kill more than 10 members of her own family. But in 1954, when Nanny was questioned by police, she had a very different explanation of her habits of poisoning her family. And she echoed the explanation in a prison interview, saying that despite various insurance payments, her murders were never about money. They were motivated by boredom, marital boredom, and a dream of discovering the ideal husband, as described in her favorite true romance magazines. As Nanny put it, "That's about it. I was searching for the perfect mate, the real romance of life." Southern Mysteries is hosted and produced by me, Shannon Ballard. You can find more about the giggling granny, Nanny Doss, in the show notes for this episode at southernmysteries.com. And there you can listen to past episodes and subscribe to the show so you never miss an episode. If you have enjoyed listening to Southern Mysteries, I'd appreciate it if you could help other folks discover the show and help me produce more episodes. There's lots of ways you can do that. If you're already subscribed, make sure you rate and review Southern Mysteries in your player so people know that you like it. Another way to help is by listening to Southern Mysteries in the free Radio Public app. It's for iOS or Android. When you listen there, I get paid, and the money goes directly towards the cost of hosting the podcast. The folks at Radio Public have also made it easy for you to directly support Southern Mysteries from within the app. You can tap the tip button on my podcast page, and you can leave me a one-time tip for any amount. Every dollar counts, and it helps me be able to continue to host and produce Southern Mysteries. I appreciate it so much and appreciate you. Thank you for listening.
It'll be all right. We're careful.